Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, August 1st, 2018. An opposition delegate at the talks in Khartoum wants all parties to sign the deal.
The initial was done and some of the parties do not sign according to their interests, and I hope all of them are going to sign.
And South Sudanese refugees at a Ugandan camp work on changing attitudes after deadly clashes.
When the people are gathering like this, people know each other, and they go to their various clusters with the name of peace.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A member of the South Sudanese Women's Bloc says the parties must reach consensus on the power-sharing deal in Khartoum so that the peace process can move forward. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Mary Akech says the South Sudan's leaders at the negotiating table in Khartoum must be willing to make more compromises for the sake of peace in the country. Akech says she remains hopeful that all parties will sign a final peace agreement.
The initial was done and some of the parties do not sign according to their interests, and I hope all of them are going to sign. If they do that, it will weigh the compromise to the parties that, yeah, we have agreed on this, and this is where we disagree. It may not be 100% on one side.
Akech says during her interaction with leaders at the talks, each party indicated their personal concerns, but not the people's concerns.
You cannot be a leader without people. It is the people that make you to be a leader. They are the one to vote for you tomorrow, or either they have already voted for you. So they need a serious care as citizens. We need to bring the people back home to the peace we negotiate that we know will not harm them anymore.
Akech notes that many friends of South Sudan are disappointed with South Sudan's leaders, and some of them are now withdrawing their aid from the country. She calls on the negotiators to focus with one heart on how to end war in South Sudan.
Friends of South Sudan, international community, and the rest of the nation that make their concern on South Sudan, they are so interesting and concerned to bring peace to South Sudan. Why not us, South Sudanese, accepting it to ourselves that we also need it?
Akech says she appreciates the role of the regional countries to try to bring South Sudanese together and discuss the future of their country. But she believes peace can only be achieved in South Sudan if its leaders demonstrate serious political will. Akech says the mechanism used by the Sudanese mediation team at this round of talks has contributed to the delay in reaching some consensus.
Part of the engagement is also part of the peace, because when you are engaged of the peace activities, it means that you are in business. But when you're given one document, the same document tomorrow, it does not make any much impact.
Delegates at the talks say they have not been told what next phase of the talks will be, but the Sudanese foreign minister announced last week that the final deal will be signed on August 5th. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
South Sudanese refugees at the Rhino settlement in Uganda's West Nile district of Arua say the politics of their country, deep-rooted misconceptions they hold about each other, and the ongoing struggle over meager resources in the camp are just some of the biggest challenges facing refugees, which could tear their communities apart. South Sudanese from different communities met face-to-face to talk about persistent and even sometimes deadly conflicts at the Rhino settlement. Simon Peter Apiku has more for VOA from Arua.
The community-based group Youth for Social Advocacy Team organized yesterday's intercultural dialogue for South Sudanese refugees at the Rhino camp in the wake of violent clashes at Rhino's Tika zone, which left four South Sudanese refugees dead. Tika resident James Nyal says it's good to bring together cultural and religious leaders as well as women and youth from all ethnic groups.
This is a way of bringing peace among the community, because when the people are gathering like this, people know each another, and they go to their various clusters with the name of peace.
Representatives from the Office of the Prime Minister's Department for Refugee Affairs, the UN Refugee Agency, and NGOs operating in the settlement attended the day-long meeting, along with South Sudanese refugees like Anna Annett, who says the deep divisions among her country's political rivals at home often spill over into the refugee settlements.
We came from South Sudan because of the war. We are fearing to die. We came here because the country of Uganda is peaceful, but still what is in South Sudan, we are still applying it here. So my comment to the South Sudan, my brothers, sisters, we should start peace with us.
Refugees say conflicts usually start between a couple of individuals at water or food distribution points and later draw in family members and eventually entire communities. John Jaldak, director of the Youth Social Advocacy Team, says the gathering accomplished some of its goals.
One of the objectives, one, was to break this barrier of people fearing to talk to themselves face to face. It was not an easy decision to make, but we say if our communities will be able to talk together, we will have achieved something.
Duck says while he realizes such deep-seated issues between different ethnic communities cannot be resolved in one meeting, continued sensitization campaigns can make a difference, especially if religious leaders get involved.
So what we have had here with the leaders, people, leaders for the church, the Ugandan preaching churches, we leaders, we call community dialogues, telling people the good thing about the peace, and peace will start with them. So if we have peace in our heart, and if peace starts with us, we shall have peace in our own country.
For Duck, the most important thing is that South Sudanese refugees agreed to come together to openly discuss their problems and talk about solutions.
People have now known that there was something wrong. People have also known that we can use church leaders to bring peace the way they did it in their own old tradition of Sudan. People have also known that by retaliating fight with fight will not bring anything. So in the level of awareness, we have reached somewhere. The next should be implementation.
Jimmy Dralema, who works in the Office of the Prime Minister's Department for Refugee Affairs, says previous efforts by his office and the UNHCR to prevent conflicts among South Sudanese refugees have failed. He says he hopes this one will bear some fruit. After the meeting, participants all signed their names on a large banner pledging to work together for peace. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Piku in Arua.
A board member of the South Sudan Young Leaders Forum and the Archbishop of the Northern Bahar El Ghazal Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan says the Kyr administration should respect freedom of speech in the country. Bishop Moses Deng Bol says the frequent harassment of civil society activists by security agents in Juba and other parts of South Sudan is a sign that the government doesn't want the people to know their rights. Reverend Bol urged national security operatives to free the chairman of the South Sudan Young Leaders Forum, who's being detained in Juba.
The Young Leaders Forum basically is a forum which is designed to bring the South Sudanese young leaders from different regions and different organizations together, just for fellowship, to know one another, to share experiences, share skills. This is basically for building peace and unity among the young people. Not necessarily the youth, but the young leaders, people who are responsible for different organizations, who are actually the future of this nation of South Sudan.
Has your organization, the South Sudan Young Leaders Forum, ever spoken to the government about the detention of Peter Bier Ajak?
I have made an appeal at a personal level, not only as a member of SSYLF, but also as a leader in South Sudan. I'm a church leader, and I have made that appeal through my Facebook page. And also I have signed a petition that was developed by some group of family members. So we have done that at my label, but not as SSYLF.
What did you say in your appeal to the government on the issue of Peter Biara Jack?
I'm basically saying that Dr. Biara is not a threat to anyone in South Sudan or anywhere else in the world. So his arrest and continuous detention by the national security is unlawful, and he should be released immediately. He has no gun. He has no intention of overthrowing the government or doing anything. He's just advancing an ideology that can either be accepted or be rejected by the government. And that is part of democracy. We have to have a freedom where we hear our views as South Sudanese.
Talking about threats, you once told me that you were threatened by a senior military officer in South Sudan who told you to shut up. Why is the government threatening people who are vocal in South Sudan?
Because the government doesn't want the citizen to know the truth. Because they know that what they are doing is not right. And if the freedom of speech is allowed, then people will know the truth. And when they know, they will engage the government. Because when people know their rights, and you know that for sure that knowledge is power. So you are basically empowering the communities to know their rights and then claim the rights from the government. Basically what we call citizens holding government officials accountable. And they cannot do that unless they know their rights. And if they know their rights, they will hold their MPs, they will hold their commissioners, their governors, ministers, and even the president accountable to them, which is not happening in South Sudan. So the fear of the government is that when you are now talking openly to the people, people will now begin to know their rights and they will begin to claim their rights, which is what the government doesn't want.
That is Bishop Moses Dengbol, who's on the board of the South Sudan Young Leaders Forum. He's also Archbishop of the Northern Bahar El Ghazal Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan. He was speaking with my colleague, John Tanza. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A new outbreak of Ebola. Find out where when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What are you most grateful for?
Grateful for my life. Because I'm alive, I have a job, and I'm happy.
I'm grateful because I'm at campus. I'm at the university. Yeah, that's my favorite thing I've ever thought of and I've ever dreamt about, being at campus.
My parents. I'm grateful for them. They've been around for me for all this long. Actually, they've been struggling to pay my school fees up to this level. It's not easy to get money, but they are paying my fees, and I'm so grateful for them.
I'm most grateful for my brothers because they are taking care of me since I lost my father in 2010, but I'm still alive because of my brothers. They are taking care of me.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. A new outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus has been confirmed today in the North Kivu province, Beni territory of the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's according to Governor Julien Paluku. He called for calm and prudence there. The DRC's Ministry of Health made the announcement today after confirming their analysis. The Associated Press is reporting there are four cases. The confirmation comes 1 week after the country declared an end to a separate outbreak that killed 29 people in the northwest part of the country. No new cases had been reported in the previous 42 days, which is twice the incubation period. It is the ninth outbreak of Ebola in the DRC, but health officials credited quick action and a vaccine for limiting spread of the disease. Opposition leader Jean-Pierre Bemba returned to the Democratic Republic of Congo today to register as a candidate in the country's long-delayed presidential election. The former vice president landed in the capital of Kinshasa today in a private jet and was greeted by thousands of supporters, including members of his Movement for the Liberation of Congo party. Bemba was imprisoned for more than a decade after his arrest in Belgium led to a trial on war crimes at the International Criminal Court. Appeals judges overturned his convictions for murder, rape, and pillaging committed by his forces in neighboring Central African Republic in 2002 and 2003. Bemba's return may energize the opposition, which is concerned that President Joseph Kabila will find a way to retain power. Fighting in the DRC's Kasai province has killed up to 5,000 people, displaced 500,000, and sent 30,000 fleeing to neighboring Angola. Human rights observers say crimes against humanity have been committed there, while others fear the DRC could be veering toward genocide. VOA's William Eagle takes a closer look at the situation.
The conflict involves the army and two opposing militias, the Kaimuna and Sapu, whose members come largely from the Luba ethnic group, and the Banamura, composed of Chokwe, Pende, and Tetela fighters. Tensions started 2 years ago when the Congolese government overruled the Bahila Kasanga administrative unit over traditional authority in several villages in Kasai Central province. Kinshasa opposed, as customary chief, the naming of a popular Luba, Jean-Prince Pandi. He was suspected of being linked to the country's political opposition. Later, security forces killed Pandi, and in response, his militia, the Kaimuna and Sapu, rapidly expanded their rebellion against the government and its allies. The government's supporters, in turn, formed the Banamura and other militias as the uprising spread to Kasai's other provinces. A United Nations official recently warned the situation is fast approaching the conditions leading up to genocide 20 years ago in the Balkans and in Rwanda. Bakwale Ndiaye disagrees. He leads a team of experts the UN Human Rights Council tasked with investigating the violence in the DRC. He says crimes against humanity have likely been committed, but they do not reach the extremes of Rwanda and the Balkans.
I don't believe that the case can be compared to what is happening now in Kasai. Although there is an instance of ethnic cleansing, we have seen sexual slavery, there have been even some instances of hate media, but not at a level we believe constitute genocide. We don't know what could happen in the future, but for the time being, our investigation did not lead us to this conclusion.
Alan Ngari is a senior researcher with the Transnational Threats and International Crime Division at the Institute of Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa. He says the definition of genocide includes an intent to wipe out an entire ethnic, national, racial, or religious group. In the DRC, there is not enough evidence to show that intent exists.
Banamura and the government forces erected barriers closer to the villages, and the Luba people were then being targeted and killed. The intent initially was to actually quell the Kaimuna and Sapu group, so it wasn't really to exterminate the Luba people, and that's the missing element. And I think this is why the international experts then said there were reasonable grounds to believe that crimes against humanity in the form of persecution happened.
Bakwale Ndiaye says punishing the guilty will help end the violence. Civilian courts in the DRC are not working, and military courts handle most prosecutions. He calls for more support for the country's courts.
All our archives are in the hands of the High Commissioner, so it is possible to prosecute. It is possible. But once again, there will be never enough courts and enough resources to prosecute thousands of perpetrators. So it should be a kind of prosecution policy and to select people at a sufficient level of responsibility, no matter who they are, be they from the armed forces, from the militia, Kaimuna Sapu, or from the Banamura, and make sure that something is done to at least stop impunity.
Ngari and others ask if politics might be part of the government's slow response. Kasai is a stronghold of the opposition, and elections are expected in December. NDI urges a reconciliation process that looks at the root causes of the violence, disarms militias, and reintegrates child soldiers. He also recommends compensation and support to victims of rape, the internally displaced, and those who fled to neighboring countries. Investigations must continue into abuses by all armed forces, including the military. Ngari says Kinshasa must begin talking with its opponents in Kasai. The central government must also take responsibility for mishandling local issues involving customary leaders and introduce ways to resolve disputes without the use of force. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
We turn to Zimbabwe now, where police fired tear gas at opposition supporters in the capital of Harare today as the primary opposition leader accused the ruling party of trying to influence the outcome of the country's elections. Figures from Zimbabwe's Electoral Commission show the ZANU-PF party with 109 seats in the 210-seat parliament. The main opposition movement for democratic change had 41 seats. EU observers say the elections were held on an unlevel playing field, citing voter intimidation. Correspondent Anita Powell is on a rooftop overlooking Harare and describes what's happening.
Right now I'm in central Harare, and I can hear live gunfire coming from the Electoral Commission, which is right next to the headquarters of the ruling party. I'm on a rooftop. I can also see a crowd in central Harare around a pile of burning trash. What we've heard is that security forces have shot people with live rounds in the center of town near opposition headquarters. I can't confirm that. I can't see that from where I am. What I can confirm is that I saw 5 Zimbabwean army tanks rolling down the main avenue in Harare on their way to the Electoral Commission. The background of that is that the Electoral Commission has yet to release complete presidential results. And opposition supporters, there were about 150 of them maybe outside the gates of the Electoral Commission this morning. Opposition supporters say that they believe that their candidate has won the election, and they believe that the Electoral Commission is going to declare otherwise. Meanwhile, observers have criticized the Electoral Commission for delaying the result, and they say that it is just feeding into this tension that really is at fever pitch right now in Harare. We can feel tear gas in the air. I can feel it in the back of my throat right now. And I can now hear people yelling and cheering from opposition headquarters. I can just see around the corner people are running and there are fires burning. And I can hear live rounds being fired.
So this has escalated pretty quickly from earlier when we talked.
Yes, it looks like right now, by the way, the crowd at opposition headquarters is running. They might be being pushed back. I can hear shots coming from that direction. It does seem that people are getting, that the crowd is getting larger and perhaps angrier. Also, in central Harare, I saw large, large rocks just in the middle of the road. People have been throwing rocks at the police, and the police were also firing water cannon at some of the protesters. Just the longer the Electoral Commission delays, the worse this might get, and that's very worrying.
Isn't this a normal process for them to take their time in making sure they're counting every vote?
So that may be the case. It may be the case, and the Electoral Commission is likely to say, you know, just take this much time to count the vote. But I think you have to take into context the Zimbabwean environment where paranoia is at an all-time high. This is a nation that's had 2 really bruising recent elections where there were very credible allegations of rigging and intimidation. And so any sense of discomfort, any irregularity is going to be felt more intensely by the population here, especially the opposition supporters. So, yes, the Electoral Commission is probably likely to say, well, you know, these things take time. But for the people of Zimbabwe who have said, overwhelmingly, at least in Harare, that they're impatient for change, the explanations from the Electoral Commission are not going to be taken very well. I'm seeing a few dozen people just running in my direction. I'm not sure what they are running from. And they're cowering against a wall. It looks like they're being dispersed by someone. I can't see around the corner and see who it is. And meanwhile, there is more live fire coming from the direction of ZANU-PF headquarters and the Electoral Commission, which, by the way, are right next to each other in central Harare. Also worth noting, protesters earlier today threw rocks at the poster of President Emmerson Mnangagwa right near ZANU-PF headquarters. It's torn to shreds. Oh, and police are arriving now in central Harare. I see a big truck of police. It's not a water cannon, just a big truck of police. They're arriving from the other side, possibly to just surround the people who have fled in this direction. I'm seeing army tanks. Right now, the main street in Harare, which is Samora Michelle Avenue, is deserted. There are very few cars out, and there are just people on the roads. That tank was going towards opposition headquarters.
That's correspondent Anita Powell speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis from a rooftop in Harare earlier today. With some African countries steeped in conflict, the Global Peace Forum, to be held in Uganda, will try to find answers on how economic empowerment can stop conflict. The volatility in the region has worsened poverty levels, which often fuels crime and instability. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
East African leaders say they need to find new models for sustainable peace and development in a bid to effectively deal with crime, conflict, and poverty. With instability taking root, leaders in the Great Lakes region are being urged to promote value-driven and innovative leadership that will provide meaning to citizens. This includes security, job growth, running water, electricity, and good roads. They agree this must be accompanied by more investment and trade rather than aid and political federation. Ambassador Fred Ngoga-Gaterse, who leads the Conflict Prevention and Early Warning Division of the African Union Commission, notes that terrorist organizations such as Somali militant group Al-Shabaab are more organized than some governments.
African countries simply don't make sense in fragmentation. We make sense in unity. Did you know how long it takes to recruit a suicide bomber, on average? It takes about 5 to 6 or 7 months. And did you know how long it takes to recruit a civil servant from the UN or the AU? About 19 months at best. So what does that tell us? It tells us that our criminals are more efficient than we are.
Delegates at the conference are also calling on leaders to improve their respective education systems to create a common goal and interest in the community. Uganda, in particular, has been working with neighbors such as South Sudan and Somalia to end conflict. Ugandan Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda notes that the conference is an occasion for leaders not only to celebrate achievements, but to find ways to overcome conflict and its daunting challenges.
As you are aware, amid this great development potential, the Great Lakes region has for many decades been characterized by identity-based conflicts, violent extremism, and refugee crisis.
The conference has brought together stakeholders from all walks of life, including business entrepreneurs. Julian Omala is a Ugandan businesswoman who ventured into northern Uganda, the area first to the brunt of the Lord's Resistance Army Rebellion, a conflict that left thousands dead and more than 2 million in internally displaced camps.
When there is no money in somebody's pocket, peace cannot be there. And when there is no economic activity in the area, the peace and the unity and the happiness cannot be there.
According to the African Union, the continent currently faces 20 crisis situations that need to be resolved. In what many have called a new dawn in the continent, last month, Ethiopia and Eritrea declared the end of war, bringing an end to a 20-year-long conflict over borderlines. It is now up to the heads of states to show if their interests are aligned with those of their countrymen and women in the region. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We leave you with the song Asumani by the Makassi Orchestra. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.